Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms
and conditions. 18 plus. So are you going to be on your phone for the whole thing, or are we going to?
I prefer that. I don't want him paying too much attention to what I'm saying.
I'm just telling you, I'm going to stop bugging me. I'm running into record. No, but I will tell you one thing. We've not done this in so long. I felt there's something. We did our first studio thing week before last. And at one point, because I will often, and we're doing it on Zoom, it's great. No one can even tell. You'll look something up. And there are a couple of times where I start going like this. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to cut. But she probably thinks I'm like, what, texting my like.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's so funny. If I'm doing this, it is because I'm looking something up.
You could be texting, one of several girlfriends.
So when you go like George Roy Hill, I'm going, oh, the director, you mean?
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
Where'd you find him? By the way, you'll there'll be some editing, even if it's light editing, right? Do you treat it like it's live, or
we
edit. We do all kinds of editing, and then
cut out all the boring parts.
We cut the boring parts.
Only the introduction.
Depending, it's all sort of like off the vibe of it. I can't really describe it. Sometimes we cut in little clips from trailers of movies. Sometimes we
do whatever the hell you want.
Joe's like profanity laden tirades about Jews and stuff. We do.
Oh, so I don't have to do that.
Like those go. No, but there was that one. Cool. What do you want to show you?
I don't know why we have it already.
I don't know. And the great thing is we can't use any of this anyway, right?
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Very, very, we are excited. We're back in the studio again.
Yep.
Very exciting. We basically only do it when it's sexy people. That's sort of the new rule. Everybody else we Zoom. I'm thrilled. I mean, I know our guests through so much work. You know him personally.
Yes, I know.
I'm very excited to meet
him.
And
you know him personally.
Yes, now I know him personally. But Bob Whitey, who is a principal director and executive producer on Curb Your Enthusiasm, a show that never fails to cause me physical pain when it's all. I'm not.
How do you think I feel?
Yes, I can't. I would love to. I feel like I would, and then I probably wouldn't. I would love to watch that happen live sometimes. But I bet there's long stretches where it's just crashing and burning, and everybody's having a terrible time.
It's about as exciting/boring as anything else you could say. I mean, the fact that it's not scripted, maybe is a little more interesting to observe. But after 10 minutes, you'd still be looking for craft services,
right? So maybe I don't want to go to that set. It's almost disheartening.
You know who did come to the set and was really excited was Edgar Wright.
Uh-huh.
And it was right after I know Edgar, actually knew him initially in England because I directed a film with Simon Pegg, and I got to know all the boys out there, that group of boys, and Edgar was in the States. Oh, it was for the release, the American release of Scott Pilgrim, and he asked if he could come to the set, and he did, and I was directing what wound up being kind of a big deal water cooler episode called Palestinian Chicken. And then I won the DGA award that year, and he went online, he went on Twitter and said that he was proud to be there on a day that I was directing. And I told Edgar that I won the award because of him, because you can't have DGA without Edgar, because Edgar has the letters DGA in it. I'm not suggesting that was a funny line, just an observation.
I know you can do better.
Is that whenever I'm looking in my contact list on my computer for DGA, enter DGA.
Oh, there you go. Sure.
And his name comes up.
Yeah. DGA. Yeah.
That's interesting. Anyway, let's move on. Are you guys regretting this yet?
No, not yet.
And then I should ask, and I'm sure this is the great thing, is I'll say something like this and be like, yeah, the other guy did that.
You stinted on his credits.
No, we're going to go through. I'm still on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I believe I cut him off.
We're still on Curb Your Enthusiasm. I have no idea. I should have looked, but, and this is Beloved Cunt.
Excuse me?
Beloved Cunt. Was that one of yours?
Oh, I thought you were addressing me in a very informal manner. Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Fantastic.
Well, awesome. For the first five, I directed the original one-hour special before we had any idea there'd be a series. It was just a one-off for HBO.
Right, right.
Totally under the radar. Nobody knew who Larry David was. And it got some nice reviews, but kind of came and went. And then HBO asked if we wanted to do a series based on the special. And so for the first five seasons, I was some form of producer, executive producer. And every year we would do 10 episodes, and I would direct at least five, sometimes six of the 10. And then guest directors would come in, and I would sort of, you know, show them how we did it, and then they were fine on their own. That was for the first five seasons. And subsequent to that, I come back most seasons, and I'll direct one episode. So I'm
for old time's sake.
For old time's sake, yeah, just to, you know, see the old gang again. But so for those first 5 years, I directed a.
So that one was okay.
The lion's share.
Because that's yeah.
And
that was a favorite.
Eclipsing even.
Oh, Beloved Cunt, yeah. Yes. I like that one too.
Eclipsing even his honorary appearance on Trailers from Hell as a valued commentator, guru, is his latest work.
We're still, he thinks I'm not, I barely begun the introduction.
Well, I thought we could mix it all together.
We're going to get to that.
I'll wait outside till you guys figure this out.
I love at the beginning too, we were getting these emails and it was clear that Bob thought like he's walking into some sort of organized thing and he needs to listen to a bunch of shows to prepare.
No, I never was under that impression. I just thought I should listen to it at least once. And by the way, yes, I'll confess I've never listened to your show, but I have a deeper, darker confession. I've never listened to a podcast in my life.
Oh, wow.
That I know of.
But is it going to change now? Or are you going to listen to this one?
No, no, I'm really going to really stay.
Neither had I until I did this one.
Really? Yeah. I don't know where to go for them. If somebody sends me a link and says, click on this and you'll hear it, I'll do it. But if they say it's Apple, I'm already confused.
They've become much more ubiquitous and popular during COVID.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But what's interesting is that most people listen to podcasts in their cars on their way to work. And when COVID came, people weren't going.
So there were more people doing them and fewer people listening.
Right.
See, I have an old car. It doesn't have any kind of satellite or internet thing or anything. And people I know, because I usually will jog during the day, I have an hour. People are really interested in this. I'm sure this is all going to get cut out. And people say, listen to podcasts when you're right. I don't know how to get it on my. I'm not quite a Luddite, but I'm something close.
You're
to
close.
go to your right now. That's an iPhone.
Yeah.
Go to your App Store.
What's an App Store?
Oh my God.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding about that.
Just type in
what's
podcast.
What's an iPhone would have been another.
Type in podcast, and there's an app called Podcast.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that on your time.
It'll take you 5 seconds.
It's going to cut that.
I'm sorry, fellas. Time's up.
But I mean, you are responsible writing or directing the Woody Allen American Masters doc, as well as docs about Mort Saul. Lenny Bruce, the Marx Brothers, telling him all this, W.C. Fields. There's a line in his new filming documentary in which he claims that nobody saw this movie. And it is the one point when I was watching this movie that I stood up and screamed, "You lie," at the screen. He's the screenwriter of Mother Night, which is a film I loved and I actually saw in a theater. I won't lie. I may have been the only person in the theater.
Yeah, you may have been.
Directed by Keith Gordon, who was an early guest at our show. It's an amazing, amazing adaptation of a great Kurt Vonnegut book, and it ties into his new film, your new film. It's always weird talking about people like they're not here. Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time, which is now out streaming, maybe still in some theaters. It is, I won't spoil it, but I will say there's a moment very early on where Bob shows up on camera and talks about how uncomfortable he is being on camera because he doesn't tend to like documentaries in which the filmmakers appear on camera. And I, knowing nothing of what's to come, I'm sitting there kind of going, yeah, I feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And then within 5 or 10 minutes, you're going, holy shit, this is the only way to do this movie. It's an amazing documentary about one of our greatest writers. It is deeply personal. I mean, it's not a huge reveal, but you guys were very, very close friends for a long time.
Yeah, which was not expected when I started out.
And no one else could have made this documentary but you. Because no one else had that access.
It is not a film anyone else could have made, and it took you
39 years. Well, yeah. From the time I first wrote
I've
to him,
deadlines, Bob,
no, but... dear Mr. Vonnegut, I'd like to make a film about yeah. you. Until now, it's been 39 years.
You can watch his hairline recede as you watch the show.
Yes.
Well,
indeed.
No, actually, oh, mine, yeah, not his though. He had a good head of hair up till the
his
very
expand.
End.
Oh my God!
Now he got more hair.
He got
more.
Yeah, hair. As yeah. Bob gets less hair, Kurt gets more.
Well,
hair.
I was donating transplants to him from my own head. Yeah. Well, I used to joke because you know, as years were turning into decades. I used to joke that it was taking so long to make the movie that you actually see Kurt age on camera. And then I would add, of course, I'm aging off camera, which you don't see. And then once the decision came for me to actually be in the film and include this sort of meta element, from the time I first appear on camera until the last the final interview was about 6 years. So I do indeed age on camera. So,
and it's really a...
But elegantly.
It's really an impressive film. And it's very moving. And if you have any affinity for Kurt Vonnegut, or even if you don't,
I would say, yeah, even if you don't,
it's a fascinating yep. journey.
Well, that thank you very much. And that's always the hope is that when you're doing a biographical film or a biographical documentary, is that you appeal to the fans, that the fans will say, hey, good, that's just what we wanted, and the uninitiated will find something to enjoy and maybe pick up a Vonnegut book.
Yeah.
You will be selling Kurt Vonnegut books for the film.
Yeah, out on the street.
Yeah.
to pay
yeah, for it.
Exactly.
No, it's, and not, because I mean, as soon as it was over too, I turned to my wife who was in tears as well. And said, we got to do it. You got to see this movie. I've been telling you about it for a long time. And we immediately threw on Mother Night and she was just knocked out. And he's got one of the great cameos of all time. I mean, it's so powerful and it's just a shot.
Well, he and I, at that point, when Keith and I made the movie, Vonnegut and I at that point had been friends for, I don't know, 20 some odd years. And so the idea was always to, and we knew he would come up to Montreal where we were filming it. And the idea was, let's find something for him to do. And so that he happened to come on the day that we shot that scene, you know, the scene because you've seen the film. And we thought, oh, let's put him in here. And it worked out quite nicely.
And perfect face for it.
Yeah.
For that shot. Anyway, that's all I'll say. I'm supposed to ask you, you are one of the guys playing chess, right?
Wow, good eye. Yeah, I had forgotten about that.
Yeah, okay.
I'm, of course, playing with myself or playing by myself or some combination of the two. Yeah. It's Nick Nolte and Alan Arkin are playing chess supposedly in Greenwich Village, although it's actually Montreal. And there's this guy playing chess by himself next to them. And that's me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's, I thought so.
That actor,
that's really, those are the questions I have.
That actor's name is Taft Hartley.
Do we have time to talk to him about his movies, Joe? Or
I don't know. You used up quite a bit on the introduction.
I know that happens sometimes. But Bob, obviously it was just sort of fortuitous. You had an amazing film coming out and you were talking to Joe and we were like, let's get this guy on. What makes him tick? What kind of movies does he like?
And well, it's pretty apparent what kind of movies he likes because he's definitely the subjects for his documentaries are,
interesting.
We'll be back next week, folks.
Listen, you go back to my high school yearbook and you will literally see autographs from my classmates that'll say things like, to the biggest Marx Brothers, Woody Allen, Lenny Bruce, Kurt Vonnegut fan I've ever known. And you see that repeatedly. And those have all become subjects for my documentary. So my documentaries have been covering these sort of, you know, adolescent obsessions of mine. I don't mean the obsessions are adolescent. I was hit by them during my adolescent years. And I remain fascinated by all of them and a fan of all of them. And you know, making these documentaries is difficult. It takes a long time. And if you're going to invest that kind of time and blood, sweat, and tears into a project, it had better be a subject that you love, you know, because, you know, it's grueling. And, you know, there are a lot harder things than watching all of Woody Allen's movies again or watching W.C. Fields' movies or whatever. So it's a pleasant way to torture yourself, I find. I mean, I couldn't do a documentary on a subject that I wasn't truly involved.
Yeah,
no,
I can't imagine.
Too hard.
That would be grueling. So what, aside from them, what kind of movies?
That's really it.
Oh,
well, I was thinking.
So go see all of his docs and you'll get the picture. And
yeah, I was thinking about doing this today and I actually did Ileana Douglas's podcast a few years ago. I guess she stopped doing it. I just found out she moved.
Yes, she moved to Connecticut.
Yeah. What are we going to do without Ileana?
Now she comes back occasionally. She came back to do some more trailers.
That's why God made Zoom.
Yeah. Was that him? Or her? So I did her thing, and her thing is, what's the first movie that you saw? And I thought I'd bring that up briefly. And when I said it, she said, you know how many people have come on the show and have said that's their first movie? So these would be all people roughly my own age. I'm 62. I was born in 59. But the first movie was Mad, 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 Mad World, which I saw at the Cinerama Dome, because I grew up in Fullerton in Orange County. So we made the trek into Los Angeles, and it must have been a fairly new theater at that
time. It was actually the first show.
Was that the first
thing run at that theater?
Yeah.
It was actually intended initially to be three camera or three projector Cinerama. But by the time they finished it, they had sort of abandoned that process, and they were not, you know, using a single camera thing. And it was the inaugural attraction.
Yeah. Now look.
At least the theater is still there.
Yeah. Thank God. The wrecking ball hasn't hit it yet.
No, we don't know anything.
But so that was the first, and that was that, you know, was that a movie that made me? I don't know. I've gone back. I've seen it as an adult. I enjoy it. I'm not like Michael Schlesinger or a friend who's obsessed with that movie.
That's what's so deep.
Literally calls it the best movie ever made.
It's the best movie ever made.
I know.
But it's a lot of
much, fun. I think. But were you aware of all those comedians at the time?
Probably not. I mean, what year was that?
63.
I would have been four. No, that's probably my introduction to all of them. Right?
Yeah.
And, but they were still funny.
Well, they were still funny. I mean, the movie was funny. What's not to like about that film for a four-year-old? Michael. Yeah.
That's my question. So
by the way, I even got the pun. I even got the gag of Jimmy Durante literally kicking the bucket. Somehow I knew that phrase and even understood that. And that already, in fact, I think my brother might have said, he kicked the bucket, or somebody in the theater shouted it out or something. But I got that. And it was just marvelous. And it was good and long and had an intermission and had an overture. And I miss those movies with culture.
But isn't there, and now I'll, because of course he'll be listening because you're on, and someone, even if he doesn't listen to all of them, will tell him that we're making fun of him. So I should say.
We adore Michael.
No, absolutely. I'm constantly baffled, and I give him grief all the time about that particular thing. But, and it ties in, your film and your relationship with Kurt Vonnegut reminded me very much of my own with Harlan Ellison, who always said that the secret to being an artist was to be able to fully access your inner four-year-old. Mm-hmm. And is it not possible that Michael Schlesinger is simply a purer artist than any of us sitting here who don't find Mad, 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 Mad World to be the greatest movie ever made now that we're adults?
Yeah, I think, he loves comedy. Yeah. And he
loves all those actors.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, and as do I. And when you, movies on, I click it on. I always watch some of it. You know, okay. I do because it's. I know it's. People think it's turgid, and you know, and Stanley Kramer, what was the phrase? This is what happens when a man who doesn't understand drama directs comedy. it was a very prescient movie in the sense that it was the spectacle of it became. Yeah. Part and parcel of what people went to the movies for, which was kind of new then. Mm-hmm. All that stunt work and everything, that was you didn't often find that in that kind of comedy.
I watched it again. Actually, they showed it at the Egyptian a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And I brought my wife, and who had never seen it. And this time, I particularly liked Phil Silvers. I think I have, you know, a deeper appreciation for Phil Silvers now. So his plot line and his acting in the movie when the car is going down the river really made me laugh. But you know, my wife's favorite story within the film was this is kind of funny. She just really laughed at all the airplane stuff with Buddy Hackett and Mickey Rooney and Jim Backus. When Jim Backus passes out and they're trying to fly, she was just laughing like a little kid. She was laughing so hard. And it was great for me. It's kind of like, I mean, my wife and I are child-free. But it's the way how when you're a kid, you love Disneyland, then you grow up and you don't really care. But then you go back again with your own kid, I hear, and enjoy it through their eyes. So watching the movie again with my wife, watching it for the first time and enjoying it like a little kid.
That's one of the fun things about movies is introducing them to your friends and introducing them to your loved ones. And it's always disappointing when they don't get it.
You know? And you find yourself like rooting for the Marx Brothers. Who has to root for the Marx Brothers if the person isn't getting it?
Come on, guys, you can
them.
Do it.
Yeah, it's them. It's not the film, you know.
What I got? Did you watch on TV or did you take her to a theater?
No, at that screening at the Egyptian.
Pay attention, Josh. Okay, yeah, no, that's
obviously. He does listen usually.
I did want to make sure that because I can't imagine. My wife Nancy has never seen it, and if she ever does, we will go to a screening. I can't imagine throwing it up on the screen and just the two of us watching it.
Yeah, I mean,
it seems like you have to.
It's a souvenir of an experience.
Yeah. So that was fun. And then the next, again, not a movie that made me, but a movie very important to me during my childhood was Mary Poppins. And again, what 5-year-old isn't going to want to go see that again and again and again? Which I did. That's the first. Now we did see Mad World. In Orange County at, I think it was called the Century 21 Theater, no longer there, which was a big wide screen. So I know I saw that at least twice because I remember seeing it there. Mary Poppins stayed at our local theater, Fox Fullerton, where I grew up, Fullerton, California, for quite a while. And I remember seeing it at least five times because I remember going to see it. And our housekeeper said, you know, where are you going? What are you going to see? And I said, Mary Poppins. She says, how many times have you seen that? And I remember holding up 5 fingers on my hand. I still have that image. So that's how I know I can access that memory as an adult and know that I saw it at least 5 times.
That was one of mine too. Yes. Yeah. Many, many times. Again, and I always maintain that it either screwed me or set me on my path. Cause to this day, the notion of, if you give me a choice between flying a kite or going to work in a bank,
I had to think about that.
You know, yes. it's pretty clear. It's a wonderful film.
You know, I'll say this in general about movies you see as a kid. Now, Mary Poppins is a movie that's basically designed for kids. But I have the privilege of being friends with Alexander Payne, and hanging out with Alexander is just always interesting because he's such an interesting guy. And like many people, I know much more encyclopedic about movies than I am. I mean, I've got my areas where I know I could, you know, certainly place in a Marx Brothers trivia contest,
right,
or, you know, a few other topics, but I'm not encyclopedic. And I admire people who are, and I sort of wish I were. Alexander is one of those people who seems to know everything about movies. But he and I were talking about, and we're roughly the same age. I think he might be a year younger than I. You know, we were talking about how if you went and pitched a movie to a studio now, just whatever the idea was, and, you know, they would want to know what the demographic was, what the age group is that you're appealing to. And, you know, maybe there's some elements in it that would make it sort of a, quote, family film. But then there's certain rules you'd have to follow. Well, okay, you have to have a kid in the film because kids want to see other kids in the movies, and you have to have these elements and maybe have some contemporary music or whatever. But there are films that are made for kids now and designed for kids, and they're movies that are sort of made for adults. And we were talking about how when we were kids, yes, we'd occasionally see a movie that was made for kids, like a Disney film or whatever. But otherwise, we really saw all the movies that grownups were seeing,
yeah,
that everybody was seeing. I didn't need a kid in the movie. There was no kid in French Connection.
There weren't as many kids' films either, not by half.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a kids' movie, an actual kids' movie with movie stars in it. I remember when I was a kid, and I'm a bit younger than you, but similar stuff. It just seemed like they were rare. It was amazing. I get to go see a kids' movie with my dad, but right, I was perfectly happy going to Magnificent Seven.
Right. But it also seems sort of commercially motivated now they've decided, okay, kids' movies, if it's a family movie, it can make a lot of money. So again, what are the elements that go into this movie? Right. And then it's sort of reverse engineered from there. But when I was a kid, I mean, The Godfather, that's hardly a kid's movie. And I was probably, you know, 12 or maybe 13. I think of, you know, The Exorcist had a kid in it.
She's fun. Yeah, see, there you go. There goes your stupid
and
theory,
some
Bob.
PC, yeah, well, there goes, you know, French Connection, Patton, all those great movies from the 70s. And, you know, I went to see movies with my parents, and I remember seeing R movies. It was kind of funny because I had to be with my parents to see an R movie, and you don't want to be with your parents when you're seeing an R movie.
No.
And I think the first R movie I saw might have been MASH, and I came away, you know, sort of fixated on Sally Kellerman's breasts. I think that may have been the first breasts I saw in a movie.
Have you ever seen?
I have to mention that to her if I meet her one day.
There's a.
She'll probably say, "I hear that all the time."
I think it's a Criterion disc of Shortcuts. And I remember I've always been a Lyle Lovett fan. I always love his presence in films, but he talks about it in an interview that the first time he calls them a lady's boobies, were Sally Kellerman's in MASH. I remember watching and going, oh my God, me too. But just the way he talks about them is so, you should check it out. We are a small tribe. I have no idea what it means.
We gotta have her on the show.
We should have her on the show. But
then I saw, oh, poor old Valerie Perrine. You know, I tried to get a couple of publications to do a story about what's happened to her. You know, she's got very late stage Parkinson's, Valerie Perrine. She's in very bad shape. Somebody made kind of a homemade movie about her. I mean, it's a nice little documentary. It's about a half hour. It's just called Valerie, but she's in very bad shape. And I tried to get, I'm not going to name names. I tried to get somebody at the LA Times to write about it because there's a GoFundMe page to help with her medical expenses. And nobody would take the bait. Anyway, I mentioned her because her breasts were lovely in both Lenny and Slaughterhouse-Five, you know. But we can move on. We don't have to talk about breasts all day. I don't think you're even allowed to do that now.
But we are. My movie night is watching Slaughterhouse-Five this week, and kind of kick-started by watching your documentary. I've not seen it since probably I was a child.
Slaughterhouse?
Being taken to the wrong, you know.
It's great. Film. I mean, maybe we'll get some time to talk about George Roy Hill in general. But,
okay, yeah.
But it's a terrific movie, and I didn't see it when it first came out because I wasn't into Vonnegut yet. I got into Vonnegut like in 76 and then saw it and loved it, saw it multiple times. And I should say Vonnegut loved it as well.
Mm.
And he said when Slaughterhouse-Five came out, now this sounds aggrandizing, but he was very fond of my movie, Mother Night, that I did with Keith Gordon. And I know he wasn't just saying that to me because I came across correspondence between him and other people and he was telling them how great it was. So that was very satisfying. But Vonnegut says about Slaughterhouse-Five that it perfectly captured the spirit of what he felt about the book, that it really captured the spirit of the book. And George Roy Hill is interesting because, you know, one terrific film after another, but you don't hear his name come up a lot when people are talking about great American directors. And I wonder about that. I guess it's because it's he's not an auteur. He didn't write those films. And, you know, the same
neither
thing
did
with
Hitchcock. Neither did most of them.
Yeah. Arthur Hiller is another guy who you go, oh my God, look at all these films. Yeah, there's some turkeys, but some terrific movies in there. Nobody talks about Arthur Hiller. And because I guess those guys weren't writers.
Well, I think it's more that they
or there's no signature. There's no specific kind of signature.
At least
that's the
easily.
Same thing with Robert Wise. I mean, he always gets short shrift because he kept making movies in different genres.
Right.
And he always did them quite well. Yeah. But he didn't have, it wasn't like...
you don't look and say, oh, this is a Robert Wise movie.
Right, it wasn't like Dario Argento or Brian De Palma or somebody where it's like, okay, he works in this genre and we understand him.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because the more genres you flip through, the more...
But there's something to be said about flipping that theory. I mean, isn't there something to be said about somebody who can work in so many different genres and do a terrific job each time? And
I think they call them craftsmen now.
Craftsmen, okay.
Well, and George Roy Hill's the guy who really sort of started me down that road of really hating the auteur theory because it was that. It was like there's so many great films. And then where do you find the commonality between
The Sting.
The Great Waldo Pepper.
The Sting, Waldo Pepper, and why am I by the
Butch Cassidy.
The Peter Sellers one with the two little girls that I love.
Henry Orient.
The World of Henry Orient. I mean, that does not fit into this great, you know, they're just wonderful films that he approached the material with the tone it needed to be approached.
Solid professional.
Yeah. But the big change of life moment for me, and I'm not talking about male menopause. I mean, the movie that I saw, and I saw it on TV initially, which changed my life, it was The Discovery of the Marx Brothers. And the first film, you know, this is weird. I have to come clean. I would always tell people that the first Marx Brothers film I saw was Duck Soup, that's what turned me on. And there's interview after interview with me saying, I saw Duck Soup and it. And for some reason I lied. It wasn't Duck Soup. It was the coconuts.
Here comes a scoop. Here comes a scoop.
That would be a reason to... No, it was The Coconuts. But
really?
The Coconuts is, you know, a terrific film, but so clunky. It was 1929. And by the way, the first all-talking, all singing musical comedy. It was the first some combination of those things. It was 1929. And, you know, you don't have to defend, I don't have to defend the film, but it's just, it's clunky technically.
It's stagey because
it's basically a film stage play. And they hadn't figured out how to move the camera. There's audio issues. There's.
And you were pretty young though, right? When you saw it?
And I was young and well.
And you saw it on TV?
Yeah, I saw it on TV. And as I recall, it was kicking off a week of Marx Brothers films.
Okay.
And I watched it for a specific reason. Was we had some kind of dress-up day at school, and I decided to go as Groucho Marx because it was easy, you know, put on a grease paint mustache and eyebrows. But I'd never really seen a full Marx Brothers film. I had seen scenes here and there on TV.
And the TV series and the quiz show, I'm sure you would see.
No, I was too young to have seen it the first time around.
Because was in syndication forever.
Right, but then it disappeared and then came back on in the midst of my Marx Brothers obsession. So that was
It came
real
back in like the 70s.
Yeah, it did. It was like 76 or so. Or maybe a little early, maybe 75. But in any event, so I said, I'll watch a Marx Brothers film to see how to do the makeup and the hair and all that. And I saw the coconuts and there was no looking back. And then I saw them all. And they were truly my obsession. Well into college. I mean, to this day, I'm on the Marx Brothers Facebook page, the Marx Brothers Council, every day. It's one of my favorite places to go on the internet. And there are plenty of other people there who have exactly the same story as I, that, you know, they just fell in love with the Marx Brothers. And no one can really properly analyze. I mean, you can come up with theories about why you love them and about their comedy, but it just goes straight to your marrow.
And when I was in summer camp in 1961 in Woodstock, New York, there was an art theater that they used to take the campers to. And one night they were running a double bill of Night at the Opera and Day at the Races. And when Night at the Opera was on, I had never seen an audience laugh as hard as they did in this movie. Mm-hmm. And there are lulls in it because it's got the romance and all that kind of stuff that Thalberg said, you got to have that. Mm-hmm. But people were laughing so hard that some people had to leave the theater.
Wow.
Because they were getting the dry heaves from laughing so much. And I had never ever, and I have never since seen anything like that.
Wow.
And so when I thought this is obviously the funniest movie ever made. So when I went to college in Philadelphia, I found it playing in a theater, you know, underneath an underpass somewhere, and I dragged my friends to see it. It was an empty theater. And of course, the plan that they had of taking the stuff out on the road and leaving space for the laughs didn't play so good in an empty theater.
Yeah, right.
Nor does it play that well on television.
Right.
Which is why the only way you can really appreciate the Marx Brothers is to see them in a crowded theater, because the movies are calculated for the laughs that they knew were coming because they had taken all that stuff out on the road and tested it.
Right.
And I think that after those
what we were talking about before, you're rooting for the Marx Brothers and you feel like they're bombing.
Right.
And then I think after those two pictures and Thalberg, I guess, passed away.
Right. In the middle of Day of the Races.
Right. So then the movies start to, you know, lose their luster, even the MGM ones.
Yes.
You
know. Thalberg believed in their potential at MGM, and once he was gone, they sort of lost their champion. And then they were in the hands of Mayer, who Louis B. Mayer,
who didn't get them.
Groucho had insulted him a couple too many times. And so then they became not exactly B pictures, but they were not treated in the manner in which they should have been. But
to Joe's point, I think I've told this, but what is this, our 1,000th episode? So a lot of people have made it. But I think it was Night at the Opera. I remember when I was like 10 or 11, and my mother took me to the emergency room one night. We had gone to, and we had been at Night at the Opera earlier, and they thought it was appendicitis, and it wasn't. And finally, the doctor determined, somewhere at some point said, have you been laughing a lot tonight? I literally laughed so hard I had injured myself.
Wow.
And you can't see this on the show, but this is, I just found this. This is, I'm 12 years old. That's Halloween. I'm the guy on the right.
He makes a pretty good Louis J. Stadlin.
It's my friend Daniel Goldman on the left. It's Groucho. I'm Arbo.
I'm friends with Frank Ferranti, who has made a good living doing a one-man show as Groucho. And I told him that I was writing a new one-man show for Frank. And he said, oh, really? What is it? I said, it's called The Louis Stadlin Story. And I think he found the humor marginal.
That's so inside.
That's very inside. I don't get that.
It was a Minnie's Boys?
Google it, kids. Well, he played Groucho in Minnie's Boys on Broadway, but also had his own one-man Groucho tour in the show. Frank Ferrante is Louis Stadlin.
We digress.
Yeah, this is what we did do half an hour on Bela Lugosi Beats a Brooklyn Gorilla recently.
That's
so
true. Oh,
wow. Now, let me say this too about my childhood in Fullerton. I was lucky. I was very fortunate because in my, not my immediate neighborhood, but in Fullerton, not too far away, was a repertory house called the Wilshire Theater.
Lucky you.
Yeah. So I, you know, that's where I spent so many nights in high school. And then also in Anaheim was the old movie theater across from Disneyland. In the parking lot of the Saga Hotel. I can still hear the recording for the show times. But in any event, so I had a repertory house that showed, you know, all the great art movies and foreign films and things like Todd Browning's Freaks and, you know, Harold and Maude and that kind of stuff, which wasn't a terribly old film at that point. And then if my older brother or one of my parents drove me, I could go into Anaheim and see Marx Brothers films as a kid on the screen with a laughing audience, which is the way you want to be introduced to those films, as you've just explained. Now, the other thing I would do every week, and I know this is a shared experience, you guys must have done this, is when the TV guide came every week, getting out yellow highlighter pen, finding the movies you want to watch.
Movies,
and how many of them are on at 1 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and then there's a whole thing of either talking my parents into letting me stay up late or sneaking back into the den after they had gone to bed to watch.
Really low.
With the volume really low.
On those awful nights when there's like two movies on at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, but then they're commercials, so you get to switch.
But I was also, for the Marx Brothers films, I was recording them on an old analog cassette recorder that had a mic that I could dangle in front of the speakers. So every now and then, you hear this like bad dub of Horse Feathers, and then suddenly you hear, "What are you doing up?" And it's like, there's a lot of that, but not just Marx Brothers films when I was a kid, but but the great thing about the Marx Brothers to me is they were the gateway drug because now again, I discovered them in eighth grade. So at a time when other kids my age were idolizing, you know, rock stars or sports figures, I was, you know, crazy about the Marx Brothers and from them, then you get into other films of that era, comedy films and, you know, the Marx Brothers, you might, you know, say, oh, maybe I'll check out this W.C. Fields film. And then there's that. And then maybe Laurel and Hardy. And then in my case, getting into The Silence, Buster Keaton, Chaplin, even Harold Lloyd at a very young age, you know, at a very formidable, is it not formidable? Very
formative
age. I was eating all that stuff up. And, you know, I was into rock stars too. I'd dress up as Alice Cooper for Halloween or something. But, That was the thing. And then, old movie. And then, you know, you learn about the Marx Brothers and then maybe, oh, George Kaufman wrote other things too. And then you're reading about that. You're reading about the Algonquin Round Table. And then maybe you pick up a Robert Benchley book or S.J. Perlman book. Right. And that's how my knowledge of all that expanded.
But it all
started with the Marx Brothers and specifically with Coconuts, as I've now confessed. So I don't know what my life, and by the way, that to a great degree, although I may have gravitated in this direction anyway, to a great degree, that was what led me to say, okay, I want to have a hand in this myself as I'm getting older. And of course, my first film, when I was 22, was a documentary on the Marx Brothers. So it really did jumpstart my own career. But so I owe it all to them.
Now, I feel like this guy comes up a bunch lately, but were you... I think the slight difference is I think I came to the Marx Brothers through Chaplin rather than vice versa, but it was similar thing. But were you, and you were a few years older when this came out, but did Why a Duck just blow your mind? Was the Richard Ennewheel book, was that like the greatest thing that ever happened? Or because I couldn't believe what I was looking at when I saw
it. Well, it was one of the, you know, there was a time when there were just a few Marx Brothers books other than really rare out of print.
There were relatively few movie books, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true. And then some stuff started to get reissued, and then new books were being written all the time. And Why a Duck, that yellow cover, still on my shelf. Yeah, that was important. And Arthur Marx, Groucho's son, had written Son of Groucho. Mm-hmm. And I remember going into a store and not having enough money, and they said I could buy it on layaway. And I misunderstood what that meant. I thought I could give them a buck now, and they'd let me take the book. They said, well, no, you can continue to make payment. Imagine having
a scamming a child like that.
Well, no, but I mean, imagine, you know, the book was what, maybe $6? Imagine not being able to pay for the whole thing at once. And then finally I scrounged around and got the money. I remember when Joe Adamson is a good friend, and Joe Adamson was my collaborator on the Marx Brothers documentary. When his book came out, Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Sometimes Zeppo, mm-hmm. which I still feel is the best book about the Marx Brothers movies, certainly, that cost $10. And that was so much money that I considered, when I first found it, I considered trying to steal it because I didn't have $10. It was way too much money. I didn't, though. I saved and got it. But actually, somebody gave it to me as a gift.
And so what was the, I asked, because I had the experience with a different book, it was a $10 book, and then finding out, you know, I'd saved up, and then finding out about sales tax. and my mother very kindly loaning me the 60 cents. But
I'm surprised you didn't go kind of right-wing anti-government, you know, lower tax. Damn, you could have taken a very
Well, you know, at age 9, I think I may have. Yeah.
But No, I think I understood that much. But in any event, God bless Joe and his book. But that was, so as far as official movies that made me, Coconuts, or let's just say the Marx Brothers collectively, those films, you know, definitely made me the man who I am today, good, bad, or indifferent. Now,
well, wouldn't you say that Woody Allen also was?
Well, Woody Allen, yes.
Was a big Marx Brothers fan.
That's a step on that journey, right?
Again, I literally grew up on his films because Take the Money and Run came out when I was either 9 or 10. It came out in 69. My birthday is in the summer in June, so depending on when it came out, it was 9 or 10. Well, there's nothing, like I said, what's not to love about Mad, Mad World if you're 4 years old,
right,
Michael? what's not to love about Take the Money and Run for a 9 or 10-year-old? Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that you can't understand. Maybe there's some nuance, but I saw that movie and I just loved it. And then a year later came Bananas, and oh my God, this is so great. And then I guess was the sex movie, which I didn't get to see because that was rated R. But then it was Sleeper, and then Love and Death came out by that time I was in high school. And Love and Death is a deeper kind of film.
He's growing up with you.
Exactly. That was it.
Is he taking you with him, or are you just kind of?
Yeah. Well, I just rode that wave. I was right in the middle of it. I was sort of the target audience and sort of maturing to whatever extent I've matured, but growing up as his films are growing up. Right. So they continually appealed to me as they started to change. And then Annie Hall, forget it. I mean, I was in high school at this point, had a relationship with a girl who was not Jewish. So we were like the teenage Alvy and Annie. And now let me say this about Annie Hall. I was fortunate enough to be at the LA premiere, West Coast premiere. It opened or closed. I think it closed Filmex that year. God bless Filmex. May it rest in peace. And so tickets were being sold to the public. You know, you could buy a ticket. And so I went, and you talked about the audience reaction to A Night at the Opera. This was the same thing. I've never to this day heard an audience from beginning to end, from the food is terrible here, yes, in such small portions, to we need the eggs. Just everything played huge, huge laughter. And it wasn't that kind of laughter because the director's in the audience, because believe me, Woody Allen was nowhere near the audience. He can't stand watching his movies, certainly with an audience. But just everything played, and the Marshall McLuhan bit, and the universe is expanding, and just everything played huge. The audience was going crazy. And we all felt that night, I mean, you felt the buzz in the room as it was over and you were walking up the aisle, that this film was somehow important. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we would never see Woody Allen films the same way again. We may never see comedy films the same way again. Maybe we never see films the same way again. It was that, listen, and for the people out there still obsessed with Star Wars. I mean, it won Best Picture against Star Wars, and I think Close Encounters that year, and he got the Oscar for Best Director, and Spielberg and Lucas were, And it seems almost unbelievable now, but that this little comedy, this little independent comedy, you know, so to speak, just swept. And it was just a huge moment in film comedy. And so that was it. Then this sort of interest in Woody Allen went into overdrive. And then there was Interiors. Now, by the time Interiors came out, I was already into Bergman. So I went with that and, you know.
Now, did he have anything? Because his Bergman affection was known before that. It just wasn't as overt work. I mean,
In Love and Death, there's a lot of Bergman stuff.
Yes, Love and Death.
I mean, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Love and Death was Bergman meets Bob Hope.
Oh my God, we find that to the story. But finally, I'd never seen before, the 7-hour Russian War and Peace, finally, during the pandemic, which I don't know if you've ever seen, and then watch Love and Death.
No, but I've read coverage. I understand it dealt with Russia.
It's an amazing film.
Take off on a Woody Allen joke. Woody Allen talks about taking a speed reading course, and he read Love and Death in a half hour, and then his follow up line was, "It dealt with Russia."
I mean, Love and Death. There's so much in Love and Death that is a visual nod to that. It just made it richer. Yeah. But had he been part of your what drove you to Bergman? Do you think, or is it just
no? What drove me to Bergman? And I'll get to that, because eventually, post Annie Hall, I read every magazine article about Woody, every interview, you know, going back to old magazines. The Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature was a thing I used to look at in the library to read up on subjects I was interested in, past articles. So I didn't know about his obsession with Bergman. And I want to tell one quick story about the Annie Hall premiere and then talk about Bergman, because there was a movie that made me out of Bergman's canon. But that night in L.A., as you know, our jaws were just dropped. We were walking up the aisle. And it just so happened that Tony Roberts was walking up the aisle next to me. And, you know, I wasn't, you know, didn't care about celebrities and all that stuff. It wasn't that he was a celebrity. It was just that he was in the movie that I just saw. And I had a program for the movie. As I recall, I couldn't even really speak. I just handed it to him in a pen, you know, for him to autograph it. And then he says something like, "Did you like it?" I say, "Oh my God, yes." And he signed the program. So now, what, 30 years later, about 30 years later, I'm making my PBS documentary on Woody Allen, and I interviewed Tony Roberts. And I told Tony Roberts a story about how much it meant to me that he was kind enough to sign my program, and I had just seen a movie that was going to change my life, and I felt it, and he signed my program. So we had, a few months later, the premiere of the Woody Allen documentary at the Film Forum in New York, and Tony was invited, and he came. And after the movie, Tony handed me his program and asked me if I would sign it. So he came full circle.
And now a word from our sponsor.
So we would like to really thank our sponsor, MoviesUnlimited.com, the movie collector's website. They're huge fans of the show, and they feature most, if not all, of the movies we discuss here. And if they don't have it, that means it probably doesn't exist. But if you're fascinated by the stuff that Bob Whitey is talking about, go to MoviesUnlimited.com. You can find it there. Honestly, I suppose you could stream, but you know what? When you buy your favorites, you watch what you want when you want it. You don't have to worry about the little ball spinning forever. There's tons of great content as well. Bonus features, director's commentaries, deleted scenes, all sorts of goodness. So buy your favorites at MoviesUnlimited.com. You'll find classics, imports, hard-to-find films, and, of course, new releases, too. Wayne Bobb's fantastic documentary, Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time, comes out on DVD and Blu-ray. It will be there. They will have it. The prices are great. Choices are endless. Own the titles you love and enjoy all the bonus features you just don't get anywhere else.
Click the Movies Unlimited banner on our website and buy your favorites from hard-to-find films, imports, and more. Go now to moviesunlimited.com, the movie collector's website, where shipping is always free on orders over $50.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
when I was in high school, again, this is all just fortuitous. And what led me to watch this, I don't know, but I had funny taste for a high school kid. That's what I mean when most kids, you know, were, you know, whatever. I was, you know, into old films and foreign films, but I maybe had started on foreign films, or maybe this was the start of it. But again, good timing. When I was in high school is when PBS ran Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage, as it was originally made as a multi-part TV show, series. Now in the United States, they cut it all down to make a feature film out of it, a feature length film.
Did he do that? I mean, he was...
You know, it's a good... I don't know to what extent he supervised. He might have.
Oh, really? I thought it was... Oh, okay.
I can't imagine he would have just let someone else do it. But that said, I remember there was controversy because there was talk about Lee Vollman being nominated for an acting Oscar, and people said, well, it doesn't really qualify because it was on TV already. I remember that controversy. But then they showed it on PBS, subtitles, and I just loved it. I said, oh my God. And it's a great way into Bergman too, especially if you're in, well, I think high school kids now are probably pretty stupid. I can't imagine any of them wanting to watch a film like this. You can cut that out too. But but I, you know, there are Bergman films certainly that would have been too heady even for a little nerd like me in high school. But Scenes from a Marriage is a very accessible film. There's no, you know, there's no symbolism of playing chess with death and you know, all that stuff. It's a great story, and it just captivated me. So every week I couldn't wait for the next Thursday night or whatever for the next episode. I think it's six parts, right? Mm-hmm. Six parts, I guess. And that was it. That was it for Bergman then. So then seeking out, now this is all just pre home video and VHS. Mm-hmm. So again, and you know, Bergman films aren't shown on television. So I was going off to, again, repertory houses and revival theaters and trying to catch these films. I remember when I was in, went to Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa before I went to USC. and they had in their collection a video of a Swedish documentary on Bergman. And I would just go in there all the time to look at this thing over and over and over again. And then at USC, there was a class in Bergman. And I didn't even officially audit the, I just went in for the screenings. The doors were unlocked. So I would just go in and see all the Bergman films. I had no interest in sticking around and hearing whatever the professor had to say about it. I just wanted to see the films. So I saw a lot of them that way. And then eventually came home video and everything else. And I could watch them whenever I wanted. So, yeah. And then, again, talk about gateway.
Yeah.
Now I'm into foreign films. So then it's Truffaut and an obsession with Truffaut and a lot of the new wave, you know, directors of that era. So, you find people along the way who share those interests and, you know, they become friends or acquaintances or in some cases lifelong friends, but movies are a good way to
and they bring you towards other things that it becomes this whole conversation.
Sure. And a great compliment from, I am now friends with Truffaut's two daughters, Laura and Ava. Ava still lives in Paris. Laura's in California, in Berkeley. And I saw they were following me on Twitter. I thought, well, wait a minute, hold on. I know he had two daughters. I looked them up. The names matched. So, hello, my goodness, you're following me. How nice. And they were both fans of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And they both told me, they said, our father would love that show. I can dine out on that comment for a couple more decades. Yeah.
Years.
So that was nice.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, yeah. So then there are foreign films.
Well, there's a highlight. I just got back. I just got back from Philadelphia, first time visiting my family in almost 2 years now because of this stuff. And I connected my father and stepmother up with an Apple TV so they could get more movies. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in the Criterion Channel. I downloaded the thing and they were like, there's old movies. We said, yeah, there's old movies. We hooked them up. I show them how to work the thing. And my stepmother goes, I mean, I've been trying to find Bergman films. Do they have any Bergman films? I went, oh. And I just typed in Bergman and the
Ingmar
screen.
Ingmar or Ingrid?
Yeah. And she just, I've never seen her look so. It was like, do they have any?
Did you know your mother was interested in Bergman?
It was my stepmother. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I knew she knew that. I knew she liked this stuff. Yeah, but she had not been able to find much of anything. You know, they don't rent, they don't buy. But it was like
right there in their home.
They have all of them.
Well, as we all know, there's... There's a downside to seeing things on DVD or at home. You don't have the shared experience with an audience, and especially for a comedy.
Absolutely, for sure.
You want that.
Yep.
But if you had told me in high school that someday I could own all the Marx Brothers films for like 10 bucks a pop,
yeah,
and they'd be beautiful copies yeah. that I could watch on a big screen in my house and watch some whenever
of us,
I wanted.
Some of us spent all their money on 16 millimeter prints.
Yeah, yeah, some of you.
That's the only way we can own these things. Yeah. And now, unfortunately, they're worth nothing.
I had a job at the Fullerton Public Library when I was in high school and early college, and then the same job at the Beverly Hills Public Library years later in their audiovisual, in their AV department. And I was the nerd who, you would actually loan out 16 millimeter projectors mm-hmm. and 16 millimeter mm-hmm. prints to people. They'd come and pick up the projector. You'd show them how to thread it. And then when the film came back with all the sprockets torn, I was the guy who had to repair the sprockets and fix the splices and all that. But I would bring home the projector when I could and films. And at the Beverly Hills Public Library, they had all the Harold Lloyd movies. Mm-hmm. So I watched those projected on a wall in my home in the Miracle Mile district. And that's how I saw the Harold Lloyd films before DVD.
I will tie it all back to Birmingham because I haven't done this in a long time. My uncle, who's a carpenter in Essex, Massachusetts, when I would visit in the summer, would do that. They would get, I guess, the library, he'd go get a 60 millimeter projector. And he loved showing, and I love this film. And I've been trying to find a good, anybody out there has it, or Bob has, he would show every summer Darduva.
Darduva.
I used to know the guy, I've forgotten his name. I knew the guy who directed that. He and I were friends for a while. Yeah, Madeline Kahn is
with
in
Madeline Kahn, it's a take, yes. It's have a takeoff. Have a Falika symbol, which is a, yes. yeah, this yeah, great parody of Bergman films.
With fake Swedishness.
Yes, yeah, pigeon exactly. Swedish.
It's really funny.
It's yeah. so good, and you can't find, there's it's a crappy version on YouTube, and I would kill to find a.
Well, I'd really have to scour to remember. I mean, his name would certainly be on IMDb, but God knows the contact information I had on him would be, you know, almost 40 years old now.
We must find it. We must find
but
this
yeah,
film.
That was a very clever film. What else? As far as, you know, sticking to the title of your little podcast here, another important film, interestingly, or not, I had no interest in musicals. I thought musicals were boring and silly and for sissies.
And the story stops.
I wasn't into that kind of music then. And then, God bless Jack Haley, who put together That's Entertainment. And I don't know why I went to see it. I think I had a friend.
Somebody had to take
you. A high school friend who wanted to see it. And he was kind of into this stuff. And I went with him. And holy cow.
Yeah.
That talk about opening up a world, and now I love MGM musicals, and you know, not just MGM, you know, other studios too. All the Stair Rogers movies from RKO, and but I just was blown away. And at this point, I've probably seen every film excerpted in that movie. But my God, that was a thrill,
yeah.
And it totally turned me around on musicals, and I love. And then, of course, I don't know if it was from the musicals. Or if it's the other way around, but I became such a fan of what we call the Great American Songbook, all the, you know, Gershwin and Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hart and Irving Berlin. And I love that music. I mean, that's the music I listen to for enjoyment in the house all day. So to see the films with that music in it and just loved it, loved it. And I got to know Jack Haley a little bit, and it was so satisfying to be able to tell him that. You know, that I had no interest in those movies until right. I saw That's Entertainment.
Yeah. No, it's kind of great, though, because you're seeing it. I mean, somebody else is taking the time to show it to you through their eyes in a sense of like, you know, here's what we love about this thing.
Yes, exactly. And that's my feeling with my own documentaries is I've made the comparison that, you know, when I was a kid and if you bought a record, you brought home, you know, a vinyl record and you put it on your turntable and you put the needle on it. And it was kind of a big event to get a new record. You know, in my case, I would invite a couple friends over. We'd listen to it together and you'd pass around the album cover and maybe read the lyrics and look at the artwork, but you would sit down and listen to the music.
Right.
All music in my life now, sadly, is background music. I don't sit down just to listen to music. It's always on, but I'm always doing something else. And
like podcasts.
Like podcasts. But it was always it was so enjoyable if I listened to it alone at first and then had friends come over, listen to this, you got to hear this. It's great to share it. And my documentaries are, you know, wasn't Lenny Bruce funny? Let me share with you what I love about Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Or isn't Kurt Vonnegut interesting? Here's what I love about him. It's a way of sharing. And so in the same way that Jack Haley's film got me interested in MGM musicals, I always thought, well, if somebody out there sees the W.C. Fields documentary, which I also do with Joe Adamson, and says, wow, this guy's really funny, and they start to look at his films, then...
Well, if you love these things, you're prepared for the in-betweens, you know, the scenes that aren't, that get you from A to B and so right. forth. But you also understand what they are. And if you're trying to show somebody the, you know what the good bits are, that'll get them to the point where then they can enjoy, if that makes sense.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, it's a great thing to do.
Now, of course, it's a cheat because you're always showing the highlights, you know,
right.
And it's like, they're not.
And sometimes they're not quite as good if they're not in context. You know, something that's pretty funny as an excerpt.
Well, that's the great thing.
Actually, is maybe much funnier in the actual.
And then you go back and you're like, okay, I'm going to check this out. And you see it. It's even better in context. That's the joy.
So, then I would say once I got into musicals, it's funny because I was really into like all the Judy Garland stuff. I used to joke that I was one of the few heterosexual kids I knew in high school who knew all of Judy Garland's films and loved her music and actually bought her albums and all of that. But
did that ever cause you trouble? Was that
no, not until this not until this moment. I think I can still say that. There's nothing derogatory about that.
No, no.
In any event, one of the first sort of contemporary musicals that I saw that I loved, of course, was Cabaret. And, you know, it's Bob Fosse, who, by the way, also directed Lenny. And his movie Lenny with Dustin Hoffman is what kickstarted my obsession with Lenny Bruce.
Dude, really?
It came from that movie.
Really?
Seeing that movie and saying, wow, I got to know more about him.
Can we talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
I guess I would love to, one of the things about doing this is sometimes I get to, you know, somebody else gives me a new way of looking at something. Because that is one that just, I mean, I loved Lenny Bruce beforehand through a friend of mine's father had these albums under his bed and we'd listen to them.
Under his bed.
You know, and or wherever they were, yeah. The film just left me cold. And I've only seen it once. And it's just like, it's interesting because it seemed to me almost to be the opposite experience.
I actually did a Trailers from Hell for. That may have been my first trailer.
I'll
have to check it out. But it really, so
he
you were not.
He doesn't even watch the trailers. Only the ones he
there's
does.
There's 12,000 of them, Joe. It's
you owe me several.
By the way, great show. I know they're coming. I sent you a few before I left town. No, trailersfromhell.com, the greatest website on the internet.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't sound like you're a Lenny Bruce purist, but I can understand a Lenny Bruce purist watching it and thinking that Hoffman missed.
Oh,
and
sure.
I will say, now, I like his performance in the film. I think it's much more a plus than a minus, but... Yes, he doesn't quite capture the spirit of Lenny on stage. He doesn't quite have the rhythm and the just the presentation that Lenny did. So that part was a little off. But no, at the time, I knew nothing about Lenny Bruce, so I wasn't like I was comparing him to the real guy. But now that I know as much about Lenny as maybe anybody, I can still look at that film and enjoy it and like his performance and not get too hung up that it's not really Lenny on stage. But I just think, you know, like, all of Fosse stuff. It's just interesting and so well shot and well directed, and the performances are great. And Valerie Perrine is amazing in it. And
it's no dance hall racket.
Yeah, it's no dance hall or leather jacket, which even is even more inside baseball. But no, I still love that film and have bought it in every medium from VHS to Laserdisc. And then
was it the bits of him doing actual Lenny Bruce bits, did that got you when you were?
The whole story about how that could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, as a kid in high school, that can really happen. You can go on stage and use words that someone finds offensive and they can arrest you. And
that's and going you have on. To, it's practically going on as we speak.
Yeah.
As we carefully watch our words.
By the way, let me step out on a limb here and say that I think a lot of the same people who you've heard saying, you know, where's Lenny Bruce now that we need him? Or Lenny Bruce was so great. I can't believe that Lenny Bruce died for our sins and he was prosecuted.
Yeah, would have
are the same
him.
People who would cancel him in about 30 seconds. The minute he opened his mouth on stage, they'd be calling for his head on a pike.
I think unquestionably. And maybe maybe you hit it because I saw it. I've only seen it once I was a kid. And it was just as I was sort of like, you know, it was like you discover this person. You're like, oh my God, there's a movie starring this amazing actor.
I think you deserve to look at it again.
Yeah, because it may literally have been that where I was going, he's not sounding like Lenny. That could literally be it. I've not gone back since. And Lenny is not as distinct a voice in my head as he was.
There was a very good Lenny impression made by the actor who played him on Marvel's Miss Maisel.
Mrs. Maisel, yeah.
That guy was very good.
Yeah. Everybody assumes I'm watching that show because of the Lenny thing. I saw like the pilot.
It's not a major part of it, but the guy is very good.
Yeah. All right, it's going on the list.
Yeah. So the Lenny film definitely had that impact because it started me on one of my obsessions. Okay, we'll figure we have a pause or we edit a little bit.
It's okay, we're already over time.
All right, okay.
Joe still thinks these are an hour long. It's the...
By the way, I'll
say my welcome.
Just as I was thinking about things to talk about, I was thinking about, you know, the annual watch. And the annual watches that I do now are with my wife, the film that we'll watch every year.
Right.
And I say the two films that were most consistent with that is Dr. Strangelove. And, you know, every time we see it, we laugh out loud like we're seeing it for the first time. And the other film is Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which I also did a Trailers from Hell for. And here's what I want to say about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And I said it in my piece, is that Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe are so great together mm-hmm. as a team. How is it that they made that one film? If they had been teamed together like Hope and Crosby for a series of movies,
yeah.
Now the scripts would have to be as good as that. But, you know, I would watch all of those films. They were just so delightful together and complemented each other so well that it's just amazing that nobody thought. And I don't know, maybe somebody who knows the history of Monroe or of either of those actresses would tell me, oh, they tried to do it or there were plans to do so. But
or they didn't like each other.
Maybe they didn't like each other.
Who knows?
That I haven't heard. But anyway, every time I see that film, that's it. And by the way, every line out of Marilyn's mouth in that movie makes me laugh out loud. Just her delivery. She was such a great comedian. She was as good as any of them.
Yeah.
And of course, she did a few comedy films. I mean, you know, she's obviously great in Some Like It Hot and any number of movies, but she has such a deft comic touch in that film. And again, I've seen it a dozen times now, and everything out of her mouth just makes me laugh out loud. And that's something for a film you've seen multiple times.
Let me put you on the spot. Not prepared anything. I just you mentioned your wife several times, and I gather you guys have this great movie watching relationship. And I know from watching the film that you didn't meet when you were 12. You didn't. So there's a what's the best thing that she has turned you on to, and vice versa, if you can.
Well, by the way, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes was a film that she loved before she met me, and so she brought that into our household. You know, she likes movies. She's not, you know, a movie nerd. In fact, it's funny because she cannot understand my love of Bergman. Mm. You know, the times that she's walked into the house and I'm watching something black and white
something
with subtitles. Yes, and she'll say, oh, God, this isn't the night playing chess with death again, is it? It's like, no, honey, this is the one where the guy is obsessing over the silence of God. She says, oh, that sounds entertaining. So, she's the yin to my yang or vice versa. But, you know.
What do you think her favorite movie that you've brought to her is?
I'd have to think about that. I don't have a great answer for that. Brought to her. I don't know. I don't have.
Big broadcast of 1938.
Big broadcast of 1938. Yeah, it's. By the way, let's say this: we're talking about the Marx Brothers. Now, I discovered the Marx Brothers on my own. I had an appreciation for Fields, W.C. Fields, but not a deep understanding. The third film I produced was a documentary on W.C. Fields, W.C. Fields Straight Up, directed by Joe Adamson, our good friend, and I did not know, unlike the Marx Brothers, with whom I was obsessed, I was not a Fields aficionado. So I was watching a lot of those films for the first time as we were making the documentary, as research for the film. And to this day, I wonder why Fields is not a bigger deal than he is.
Well, he was a huge deal at a certain point.
No, I understand. But now, you know, the Marx Brothers, I mean, if to the extent that you can use the internet as a
right.
resource. There are a few Marx Brothers fan, you know, Facebook pages well, no, and all I, that I, that are kind of thriving, but you don't
see
that.
Period you're talking about too in the 70s when you're sort of finding this stuff, and I remember kind of, like, Fields was one of those people.
Yes.
And he seems not to be anymore.
Yes, he's not anymore.
Yeah.
And I will say this, you know, the Marx Brothers are just my favorite, and, you know, Chaplin is a genius, and there are a lot of geniuses. There were a lot of geniuses back then. To me, there's Fields may be in some way the funniest of them all, as far as just having this collection of gifts, that voice, the dialogue, the
juggling.
Physicality, the juggling, you know, his look, just so talented and so funny, where everything out of his mouth is just a gem, or he can make a little throwaway, a little, you know, mumbled line hysterical, the way he delivers it, you know, just like, years of training on the stage. And he's so great. And those films are so great. I just don't know why there isn't, I don't feel
also,
more of
he's
a current.
Awful. What's that? I mean, he's awful. And somebody, I mean, he's just, I mean, love. And it just suddenly hit me. It's like in a very similar way to Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He is, you enjoy watching him do kind of terrible things.
It's the curmudgeon thing.
But he played, he had two characters from opposite sides of the spectrum. And this is the kind of thing I picked up from Joe, is he was either the curmudgeon or the kind artist, or he was the henpecked husband. I mean, you think about it, it's a gift.
And the henpecked husband movies are the best ones.
Yeah. Yeah. He's so funny.
Man with the Flying Trapeze and It's a Gift are among the best movies ever made, I think. And they're not exactly stylish, but they are.
I can still make my wife laugh. There's the scene in Man on the Flying Trapeze where, you know, there are burglars in the cellar. And he's trying to get dressed to go down and investigate why someone's singing in the cellar. And he's taking forever. And he's trying to put his socks on, and he puts two of them on the same foot and all that. The kind of thing that can, you know, drive you mad if you're not patient. But there's a thing where he gets out the gun. Get the gun. And he gets the gun, and it's all tangled up and, you know, and it's shoelaces or whatever. And the gun fires. He shoots the gun off. And his wife just passes out onto the bed. And he looks at her and he says, "Did I kill ya?" And there's a glint of hope in his voice.
Yes.
And she says, "Oh, leave me in peace, leave me in peace." And he goes, now with a hint of disappointment, he says, "Oh, I didn't kill you. That's fine." Oh my God. What's funnier than that? So yeah, I just, you know, if anyone's listening to this and you're not familiar with Fields, please go get the DVDs or the Blu-rays or whatever you can. By the way, something else about Fields, this is going to be great cutting room floor stuff, is a lot of the comedians from that era didn't age well, meaning that part of their presentation, part of their comic dynamic had to do with youth. The Marx Brothers were men children. You know, when Keaton got older, he became a little, when Laurel and Hardy got older, you know, really older, it was sort of difficult to watch them. But Fields' character was always like an old man, a cranky old man. So his films up to the very end, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, are still great. The Bank Dick. Still funny movie because his character was allowed to age because he was always like an old man. That's my Fields theory, is why his films were good up till the very end and why a lot of those others.
But am I not? Do you not see a line from him to Larry David?
Did you just say Nazi?
I said, am I nuts?
Oh, yes, you are nuts. Do you have another question?
Yes. I think there's a line from him to Larry.
I do, but Larry doesn't see it because Larry and I, we don't socialize that much anymore, but for a time we socialized quite a bit. What was interesting was his knowledge of films from that era is practically non-existent. Mm. It would not surprise me if he's never seen a W.C. Fields film.
Sure.
He had never seen a Marx Brothers film. I went with him to see a Harold Lloyd film. He had never seen a silent comedy. He never knew that Laurel and Hardy made silent films. So his thing was TV that he grew up with. He loved Phil Silvers and Abbott and Costello, you know, from the TV show, and I think later the films as well. But he was not a fan of those films. And when I would be staging a scene for the show, I would say, okay, you know, Larry doing battle with a kid, this is W.C. Fields, or Larry hiding behind Jeff, you know, while Susie's yelling at him, this is Laurel and Hardy. Yes. You know, I'd be thinking of those precedents. He didn't have a clue.
Right. So or he'd be thinking of the TV version, which was spawned
Right. Yeah, or he'd have maybe Phil Silvers on his mind. I mean, there's a bit of Phil Silvers in Larry. Yeah. But I do find that interesting, is that for somebody who, in a way, harkens back to a different era in comedy just by being a very specific kind of character making his way in the world, that Larry's knowledge of those films is so minimal.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you know, we can fill spaces even without knowing who dug the holes originally. I suppose. Yeah.
And we can fill airtime too.
Yes. Well, we have too.
Yes,
hey,
we have. Hey. Once again.
But I'm just getting started.
Well, Bob, thank you so much. I've obviously been familiar with your stuff for a long time. I've been a fan, but the Vonnegut documentary, Unstuck in Time, is so beautiful. I mean, it is a just...
You've done a lot of great documentaries, but this might be the best one.
I mean, and there's a reason this one is different than the others, too. Unless you spent a lot of time hanging out with Groucho and haven't mentioned it, which...
No, it's very different. Well, it's crazy to spend 39 years on a film, but it was, you know, they say everything happens for a reason. I don't believe that. But that said, I think it's a much richer film now than what I was planning, which was a conventional, you know, one-hour...
Yeah,
PBS style documentary on Kurt Vonnegut.
It's fantastic. I mean, if you love Vonnegut, if you don't know Vonnegut, it's a beautiful portrait of an amazing American character. And
you
a great
will
friendship.
if you don't know Vonnegut, and you will read a book after you've seen
it. And please, after you see it, because I really did. I don't usually shout at my TV. I'm going, you lie. If you watch the doc and you go, this is amazing, and I need more. Mother Night is out there. It's streaming. It's a fantastic film. I love it to death. I would like to be able to have conversations with more people about it rather than just get those strange looks they give me. So,
the three people listening to this will all go out and watch it.
Oh, we have more than three. We have five.
Yes, five. Wow.
At least five.
Yes. Oh. Josh, can I ask you one question that I'll bet no one's ever asked you before? Would you read my screenplay?
Hey! Happily!
Happily.
Happily.
Yeah, the next piece, I will happily read your screenplay.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.